Welcome to Deemable Tech. Well, we're changing things up a bit this week, and I wanted to explain why. Of course, by now, you've probably heard the news about the tragic events that happened in Aurora, Colorado this Friday. And we're a tech show, so we don't have to talk about things that aren't tech-related. But the honest truth is that this affects all of us. It affects all of us as hosts. It affects all of our listeners as just, you know, Americans, and also as a sci-fi fans, geeks,
comic book fans,
it does affect all of us, and so it would almost be inhuman for us not to just at least mention it and express that our thoughts and our prayers are with the folks and the victims in Aurora, Colorado. I don't think there's much we can add to the conversation. It doesn't really have much of a tech angle. Not that we were, trying to exploit some sort of angle to talk about it. But
right. Yeah.
Well, I would say from a technical standpoint, I mean, compared to some of the other mass shootings we've seen in the last couple of years, this one seemed to be a lot more technically linked as far as like Twitter and Facebook and some of the update sites. I mean, you had people updating right before, during, and after.
So we got a better picture than we have of previous events like this.
Yeah, kind of
what
was happening. A digital snapshot, if you will, of that moment.
Yeah, kind of a living record of what happened. And of course, there were videos this time of I haven't seen any videos of the actual shootings happening. Which
and honestly,
I don't
thank God,
see it.
I don't want to see that.
I don't want to see that. But there were a lot of videos of people leaving the studio or the movie theater and how that event happened, and of course the news about this is spreading faster than any other event in the past too because of our social media. So there's that, but that really wasn't the reason why I wanted us to talk about it. But actually, to give you a kind of behind the scenes look at what we do here at Deemable Tech, this episode and the last two episodes and our next episode, we're actually recording so that we can save them, so that when we're on the air on the radio, we can actually show those if we go on vacation or take a break or, we're not able to record the show. So we're just putting them in the can, as they say, in the business.
And we're just, in those shows, we're trying to keep it as general as possible. So they're not time sensitive.
Right. But for our podcast listeners, you guys are listening to it every week, and I wanted you to be aware that, we're not just cold, heartless whatevers, and, that this did impact us too, and like I said, our prayers and our thoughts are with those folks out in Aurora, and...
Absolutely, yeah, 100%.
That's pretty much all I can say about it without getting upset, so...
Yeah.
So, with that, that's all we have to say about that, and now on with the show. From WJCT Studios in Jacksonville, Florida, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
I'm Kevin Clark.
I'm Aaron Edelson.
And this is Deemable Tech, the show that brings you the latest news in tech, computers, gadgets, the internet, and social networking, and then we answer your tech questions. If you need help with your desktop, laptop, tablet, or mobile phone, we're here to help. If you have a question that you want to ask Deemable Tech, give us a call at 904-372-DEEM. That's 904-372-3336. Or you can send us an email at questions@deemable.com, post a message on our Facebook wall at facebook.com/deemable, or send us a tweet at deemable. Today we're going to answer your questions about what you can do when you lose an important document, what to do when you spill your drink on your keyboard, and where to find good medical advice on the internet, and what a QR code is, and more. But first, let's take a call from a MacBook Pro user in Chicago.
Hi, my name is Joshua McKiernan. I'm currently living in Chicago, Illinois, and I have a question about hard drives on MacBook Pros. My hard drive last night unexpectedly died. I carry my MacBook with me everywhere I go in my backpack in a special sleeve designed for computers and laptops. Last night, while loading up the MacBook, it would be stuck on a gray screen for quite a bit, just kind of dialing through, and never really booting up.
That's never good.
And on looking at some other Mac forums, I found that this was the telltale sign of a hard drive problem. Mm-hmm. When I brought it to the Apple Store, and they ran some diagnostic tests on it, they said that the hard drive was actually dead, and the information on it was irrecoverable. So my question is, how, especially for MacBook Pros, how can you ensure that your hard drive lasts for as long as it is possible to last? And also, what are some warning signs that you will normally see before your hard drive fails? And the last question would be, where is the best place, or what is the best place to store any information that you want to catalog away to ensure that if your hard drive does crash, you still have some of the information that you would like? Thanks so much for your help.
Oh, okay. Well, Josh, first let me say I'm sorry for your loss. I know it sounds stupid to anybody who hasn't experienced it, but losing a hard drive can kind of be like losing a family member.
It sucks.
Or at least a family pet. It's not the loss of the hard drive itself that hurts so much, but it's the loss of everything you had stored on it. Within the last 6 months, I also lost one external hard drive at home that had a lot of pictures and videos of my daughter when she was very young, and we didn't have it stored anywhere else.
Oh,
and and at work, I also lost a hard drive that had 3 months worth of work stored on it, and it wasn't backed up anywhere else. So before I get to your questions, this is a really important point for all of us to learn. If you don't have your documents and pictures and videos backed up somewhere, it is only a matter of time before your hard drive crashes and you lose all of it. You know, hard drives just are not eternal. They're not going to last forever. They will fail.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just a fact of nature. We've all experienced it at one time or another. Hopefully, it'll be after you stop using the computer. But most likely, if you hang on to your computer for long enough, it's going to happen. And it's likely to happen while you're using it. So what you need to do is get a backup system. Something like Carbonite or Mozy, or even just Dropbox or SugarSync that backs up your data across the internet. And we'll talk more about this in a little bit, but the reason I recommend that is because I used to recommend having an external hard drive. And, you know, have an external hard drive, back up your files to it. But what I've found, even in myself doing this, is that what happens is the external hard drive just becomes extra storage instead of an actual backup hard drive.
Yeah,
it's just too tempting. Like when I have a 500 gig hard drive and a 500 gig external, I'm just going to, oh, now I've got a terabyte, you know?
Right, yeah.
And that's the problem. Now you don't have a backup. So the only way that I've found to stop myself and others from doing it is having it online. Now, I can't give you a good recommendation personally because I'm really the pot calling the kettle black here. I still don't have a decent backup system. But that, you know, we can talk about more about that. You guys have systems set up that you use?
Absolutely.
What do you use, Kevin?
Well, I have pretty much a backup server that it's a little more technical than most people, home users, really need. I mean, it provides me with multiple disk RAID arrays, if you don't know what that is. You know, it's multiple hard drives that will allow me that it writes to. And if any one of those hard drives goes out, well, all my information is backed up on those others.
So you've actually got an extra computer set up as a server in your home.
Pretty much.
Because you're a super nerd.
Well.
And I applaud you for that.
I also have clients' information that I have to keep very safe.
So you kind of have set up your own cloud in your house for your clients.
Pretty much.
Okay. What about you guys? Do you use Carbonite or Mozy? Or?
Well, I'm using a Chromebook, so let me tell you how to back up a Chromebook. That's right. You don't have to back up a Chromebook. Everything is stored in the cloud, so you're already backed up.
Let's get tacos.
Well, so, you know, and this doesn't replace a backup, but just from Josh's question about how do you know if your hard drive is failing, there's a really simple tool that I use a lot called Crystal Disk Info. It's a free download. Just Google Crystal Disk Info.
Does that work on Mac, too?
You know,
or is that a Windows?
It's a Windows thing. I don't. Actually, I'm pretty positive there's not a Mac version of it.
Okay.
But you could always take the hard drive out of a Mac and hook it up to a Windows machine.
That's true. Well, most
you know how to do that.
Not saying anything disparaging against Mac users, but most Mac users, I'm assuming, wouldn't know how to do that.
Sure.
Well, and especially if you're running a new MacBook Pro or a MacBook Air, you can't.
Right.
Yeah. So. Well, that's very true.
The thing to keep in mind, too, is most of these disk check utilities are designed for physical hard drives that have spinning platters, not the new SSD, which is the solid state drives, which are built off flash technology like the USB thumb drives and memory cards.
And the Crystal Disk Info does not. It doesn't tell you the health status of a solid state drive.
Let me chime in real quick and maybe talk about a little bit briefly about the technical aspects of hard drives so people kind of understand what's going on here.
Well, actually, before you do that, to answer Josh's second question, there's except for, you know, some diagnostic tools, usually there's really no way to tell if your hard drive is about to die.
Unless it's making funny
noises.
Often
it just dies. One day you're just typing along and all of a sudden your computer's dead. Sometimes you'll be lucky enough to get a few warning signs, like a clicking hard drive or some strange noises coming from the computer.
It's kind of like a flat tire. I mean, sometimes you have a slow leak where over time you notice problems as it fails, and sometimes just catastrophically you wake up one morning
it blows
and it's
out.
Just not there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also, if your computer starts getting really slow or if it starts freezing up a lot, and this is across the board for Windows and Mac users both, then you could have a potential problem with your hard drive, but none of these are really absolute signs that your hard drive is about to crash, but it could mean that.
It could mean that. And I would say if you see anything like that, whenever my computer does something freaky, I'm like, oh, time to back up.
Yeah, that is a huge sign. If you see that, it's like, you know, when you start, you know, having heart pains, you know, go to the doctor, which we'll talk more about later.
Yeah.
and your backup system, the best thing to keep in mind is you should never back up less than you're willing to lose. So for some people, that may be a month of data if they don't use their computer very much or only go online for emails. For some people, that may be every couple hours they're backing up if they have a lot of work that they do on it and don't want to lose anything.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So to kind of get into what's going on with the hard drive, hard drives are just like they're the biggest point of failure on any computer. Like Ray said, it's not really a question of if but when your hard drive will fail. The reason hard drives are so fragile is they have a lot of moving parts inside those little metal boxes. And don't take yours apart, by the way, unless you are done with it forever. Basically, you have a stack of round spinning platters, kind of like, you know, a stack of record players. But each
CDs.
Each player has an arm that travels across it and reads it. But unlike a record player, there's not any permanent grooves. It's using magnetized rust particles, similar to like cassette tapes. So it's sort of a combination record player cassette tape. And then, you know, there's just a lot of, you got these heads that are reading the hard drive. You've got these spinning platters. You've got, these particles moving around. There's a lot of ways that can go wrong.
Yeah. And especially with laptops, I mean, they were just never designed to go through what we put them through.
Right. You know, but you're picking your laptop up, you're carrying it around, that jostles all that stuff in there.
Yep. And so solid state drives, SSDs, like we were talking about, like the ones that are in the new MacBook Pro and the MacBook Air, they will last a lot longer than traditional hard drives.
Yeah.
But there are some inherent problems with them, too, that we were talking about yesterday.
Yeah, something that people need to keep in mind with these non-moving drives, the SSDs, is that they still wear out. Not the same way that a moving drive does. Your standard hard drive has, like you said, moving platters, so the bearings will wear out. That little reader arm eventually will start clicking as it stops reading. But the SSDs, they read and write on pieces of the drive. So without getting into the technical details of it.
Which involves quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's actually quite complex. But without getting into all of that, I mean, it's essentially like kind of scratching the same spot on your skin. If you keep scratching it over and over, eventually you're going to have like a hole in your skin. Same thing with the drive. Eventually, you're going to have a bad spot on that SSD. Right. So the more you use them, eventually they will begin to wear out.
Now, just for personal experience, I love the Apple Store and I love Apple Geniuses. But just if this had happened to me, the first place that I would go would not be the Apple Store.
Really?
And no disrespect to them. The reason why is because there are some methods where you might be able to restore your data that the folks at the Apple Store are not going to try. So personally, I'd rather break my warranty than lose months or years worth of data. I won't go into details into the methods right now here on the show because we could fill two or three episodes with all that. And it sounds like, Josh, that you've already taken yours into the Apple Store for repairs, so it's probably a moot point anyways. But for our other listeners, or if you haven't actually taken it back, Josh, if this happens to you, contact us first. Give us a call, and we'll see if we can help you out with it, or we'll get you in touch with somebody who can.
Right.
Now, if we refer you to somebody, I'm not necessarily saying it'll be free. These services often can run upwards of $600 to $1,200 to $1,500 But when it comes to priceless memories like photos or videos of your newborn daughter, like me, or irreplaceable things like a manuscript that you wrote, sometimes it's just worth it. So just wanted to say that for you guys. But we have got to take a break. So when we come back, we'll take some more of your calls. This is Deemable Tech. Up next, we'll be taking your calls, reading your emails, and answering your questions. If you have a tech question for Deemable Tech, give us a call at 904-372-DEEM. That's 904-372-3336. Or send us an email to questions@deemable.com. If you missed an episode of Deemable Tech, or you just want to hear the show again, be sure to subscribe to our podcast by searching for Deemable Tech in your favorite podcast app, like iTunes or Google Listen. If Deemable Tech isn't listed, you can type in our podcast URL, which is dmbl.co/pod. That's dmbl.co/pod. Also, be sure to follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/deemable, or on Twitter at deemable. You can also find us on Google Plus. Just search for Deemable Tech.
Welcome back to Deemable Tech. Coming up, we're going to talk about where to find good medical advice online, what a QR code is and how to use them, rooting your Android, how to connect Outlook to any email service, and whether hacking your laptop is legal. But first, we've got a question from Michelle that we got via email.
Let's see, Michelle says, I am a Christian psychologist and work primarily out of my home. I have been recently writing a book about addictions and had to run out of the house unexpectedly in the middle of one of my writings. My oldest son confessed to being on the computer while I was away. However, he said he never touched anything I was working on. Unfortunately for me, it looks like I have lost at least 2 days worth of writing.
Ouch.
I'm sure I can recreate most of it, but it would save me quite a bit of time if I could recover it somehow and possibly prevent this kind of thing from happening again, short of locking my office door. Is there a way for me to do this, or have I lost it for good? Another question about data loss here we got. Kevin, what would you recommend for her?
Well, Michelle, there are many factors that could be the saving grace of your situation. First, it really depends on which operating system you're working with, and pretty much like we were talking about earlier, you know, what kind of backups you might have set in place. Since we're limited on some of the particulars of the situation, I can touch on a few of your best options and just assume a few things. If you're using the most current version operating system for Windows, which is Windows 7 for now.
Windows 8's coming in October, it looks
like. That's right.
You can try using the previous versions feature. But before I tell you how to use it, I'll tell you a little bit about how it works. Your computer can do things called restore points, which bring you back to, you know, they're primarily used to bring you back your computer back to a previous state or a previous date. And you can use these restore points to also restore specific documents to a previous state.
Are these restore points created automatically, or?
Sometimes they can be. You know, whenever you update your computers, the Windows updates many times does a restore point, especially if it's a critical type of update.
Like even a service pack or a major driver update, a lot of times will do an automatic restore point.
Even some third-party programs will do their own restore point. And you can set one manually yourself. In fact, I'll just go ahead and walk you.
Show me how that works.
Through a manual. You know, if you're using Windows 7 and you click on your start button, you can go up to where it says computer. You can right click on that and choose properties. And on the left side of the screen, it'll say advanced system settings.
Hang on a second. Okay, I see it. Advanced system settings.
And once you get in there, that's your system properties. If you click on the system protection tab, at the very bottom, it says create a restore.
Hardware, there it is, system protection. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
No, at the very bottom of that tab, it says create a restore point right now to drive that drives that, what did that say?
Create a restore point right now for the drives that have system protection turned on.
Exactly.
Okay.
And you just click create there.
All right.
And you get, and you can type in whatever you want. You can say Kevin's restore point or my, you know, restore point for this date, whatever you want to do, and create your own restore point there.
Oh, okay.
So getting back to the original question about previous versions, whenever a restore point is created or whenever a full Windows backup is created, it creates what they call a shadow copy. And if you had made changes to your document before, from before that system restore point was made, you can take that very document back to a previous state that you're working on. And this works really well for, well, Michelle's situation, or if maybe you're in an Excel document that you update constantly, you know, and you just needed to go back to a specific time.
It sounds like, though, she it sounds like the whole file's lost. I mean, like, she didn't save it at all.
Well,
and doesn't Windows Office auto save now? But I guess you have to save it at least once, and then it will auto save new revisions.
It does, but I don't know. It sounds like maybe her son was on it. Maybe he deleted something he didn't realize. And you know, if a restore point was made, then she
it would
could
have a,
you know, they would have a previous version, and she might maybe able to recover it.
And obviously, if the file's missing, check the recycle bin.
Yeah,
I mean, that's where I would start first. Absolutely. Check the recycle bin to see if it was deleted.
And then you can do a file search, actually. If you remember the name or part of the name of the file, you can do a file search.
You know, we got another email from Kristen that was on a similar topic. Mm-hmm. Tom, can you read that one real quick?
Sure.
You got it there?
She says, I've got an old PC running Windows XP and Microsoft Office 2007.
Okay, similar, yeah.
It's a pretty old computer, but it lets me surf the internet and use Word, and it didn't cost me anything. But here's my problem. Yesterday, I was working on a really important paper for work, and the power went out. Stupid me, I hadn't saved in like an hour. Is there any possible way to recover my document?
So with Office, there are some things built in where you can recover some documents too.
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing I would do would be to open Microsoft Word back up, because Word, since 2003, has had sort of this auto-recover feature where it will try its hardest to get back whatever you were working on when it was closed. Now, it may not be the absolute latest version. It saves
everything. Yeah, because I was going to say, that saved my rear end a few times.
Yeah. It saves every certain number of minutes. You can actually check this, by the way, as a preventative measure. If you click on the Microsoft Office button in Word and choose Word Options, you'll see a thing that says, make sure that it says save auto-recover information every blank minutes. Make sure that's selected, and then you can change the number, and you can make the number as low as you like maybe 5 minutes, and that means that it's now going to do this auto recover save every 5 minutes in the background. And having auto recover save more frequently really shouldn't impact your computer's performance in most cases. Modern computers are fully able to handle that.
And of course, like Aaron mentioned earlier, the easiest solution to all this is use Google Drive.
Yes.
Because what I love about Google Drive is that it waits until you take a pause, and when it pauses, it saves it.
Yeah, and it's on the internet. It's in the cloud, so you know, it's not confined to a single device. If your hard drive goes bad, whatever, doesn't matter.
I will make a quick comment about the previous versions you mentioned, Kevin. That's actually available to some Windows Vista users as well that are listening, but only professional, Enterprise and Ultimate versions. Uh-huh. They made it available to all users with the Windows 7 upgrade.
Yeah, and just to kind of finish up that thought about the previous versions, to now tell you how to actually use it, I told you how.
Sorry, I cut you off there.
No, that's all right. I told you how it kind of works in the background, but to actually use that function, you just go to the icon of the document that you're trying to go back to.
So you're not going in actually through Microsoft Word.
No, you're not going you're not opening up the program. You're just going to the icon of the document.
Okay.
Maybe it's in your documents folder or it's on your desktop. Well, you're going to right click on it. You're going to choose properties, and you're going to see a previous versions tab there, and you will see either one or multiple dates that could be, you know, what you are looking for.
Now, you said that it backs up whenever you do a restore point. Is that the only time that it will automatically save a previous version of that file?
Also, when you do a full Windows backup, it'll do that too.
So the Windows built-in backup, not necessarily a third-party software.
No, not a third-party software at all.
So,
One more thing. Alternatively, I didn't want to think, you know, we're just on Windows users. Alternatively, if you have a Mac OS and you have a time capsule and you're using Time Machine on it, you know, you can always, that's a really easy
tool. Yeah, it works pretty similar to that. Mm-hmm. And it works really great. But, you know, like we were saying before, backup. Set up a backup, get it going. And, you know, something like Carbonite or Mozy, or even just with a few documents like with Dropbox or SugarSync, it'll save you from this happening in the future.
And of course, if you're, you know, make sure that you have an autosave feature. If your software has it, make sure it's enabled. And if not, make sure to save your documents, because not all software will do that automatically.
That's true. We got another email from Teresa. Aaron, you want to read that?
Yeah, it says, "Help, I just spilled tea on my laptop keyboard."
We
hear this one all the time. It says, "Have I just ruined the laptop, or is there any way that I might be able to dry it out?"
Now, Kevin, you've dealt with this personally, haven't you? Just recently.
I was drinking a certain beverage.
Made of grapes.
Made of grapes I spilled it right on my laptop keyboard, and I was like, oh man.
That's the keyboard you're using right now, right?
The keyboard I'm using right now.
Or the laptop you're using, at least, not the keyboard.
Correct, yeah.
The new phrase of this generation will be, don't drink in Google Drive.
Wow.
So I spilled it on it.
I didn't have the rim shot sound ready to go.
Well, I immediately turned my laptop upside down. I just want to make sure it did, you know, nothing got more wet.
It was actually turned on when this happened.
It was
right?
turned on. Okay. Oh yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, first off, and let me just say, if this happens to you and your laptop or computer is turned off, don't turn it on.
Yeah.
Because that could be the only time when you have problems.
And if it's on, go ahead and turn it off immediately if you spill any sort of liquid on it.
Well, that was what I did. The first thing I did, I just held down the power button. Sure, it's not the best way to shut off your computer, but I wasn't going to wait for Windows to boot down normally.
Get it off
and
immediately.
Risk ruining my whole computer. Well, I turned it upside down. I just used a hair dryer, you know, just to dry it out. Didn't you tell me you use a different method?
Yeah, actually, with a lot of things, especially with mobile phones or laptops, you know, there's this HZO thing that's supposed to make them waterproof, and I covered it a while back on First Coast Connect. But until that happens, one thing that can kind of help it from completely destroying your device is putting it in rice. If it's
really
a small device, you know, fill a Ziploc baggie up and stick that thing in there, shake it all around, and the absorbent nature of the rice will help to pull that water out. Grits also works, but it can be a little bit messier. Couscous even works. Any type of
starch
that absorbs water. Because what it'll do is water naturally, you know, turns into air, and that moisture will come out if there's something that will absorb it. So
it's
interesting.
With a laptop, you know, a big old 17-inch, you might have to get a big bag, but you know, maybe buy a 50-pound bag of rice and stick it in there. But
the good thing, I mean, what really saved my laptop is that a lot of the manufacturers are now putting a pretty big plastic film cover underneath your keyboard.
Kind of a protective membrane underneath it.
And so it protected it from the motherboard, you know, it protected the motherboard and all the real major parts in the computer. And all I had to do was swap out my keyboard on my laptop, and it's good as new.
Which, even if you pay somebody to do it, sometimes can be under $100 or around $100, including the part. So $100 for a keyboard may be a lot less than a $300 or $400 new laptop.
Okay. Well, we got another email from Brenda. Kevin, can you read that one?
Sure. Brenda says, "Every time she starts feeling sick, my mom will get on the internet and search for her symptoms. It seems like she always finds some web page that confirms her worst fears, that she has some horrible exotic disease."
This reminds me of the Redneck Comedy Tour, Blue Collar Comedy Tour. Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
Brenda asks, how reliable is the internet for this kind of stuff? Are there websites that are more accurate than others?
Okay, well, that's an awesome question, Brenda. But first, I do want to give a disclaimer. We are a tech show, not a medical show. We don't have the expertise to judge the validity of any medical information on any
website. Let's be clear, we don't even have a clue.
We don't have a clue, no.
Definitely not the expertise.
That said, here are some just general common sense advice. First of all, the first question I'd ask about a website that has medical information is, who runs it? Where does the information come from? And ideally, the answer should be from the government or a reputable university. The National Institute for Health actually has a very nice website called MedlinePlus.com. And I'd say the NIH is going to be a pretty good source of medical information if you're going on the internet for that kind of thing. Another one, the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, they have cdc.gov. If you're concerned that you might have bird flu or that you're unprepared for a zombie apocalypse, they're probably a good place to start. And you think I'm kidding about the zombie apocalypse thing,
no,
but I'm
not.
They totally have a page for that. And it's awesome.
They've done a really good job about being socially relevant.
Yeah, they have.
Doing silly things like the zombie apocalypse hand guide. It
mm-hmm.
was great.
Mm-hmm. Another nice website I've found is run by Duke University.
Oh.
You can check out dukehealth.org/health_library. And that's really a cool site because you can search their articles by topic. So I searched for headaches and immediately found a very informative article on the subject of headaches. Okay, so a lot of web searches, if you just go into Google and start searching for your symptoms, they're going to take you to a very professional looking site called webmd.com. And there you can search for stuff based on your symptoms and get extensive listings of everything that you might have and recommended treatments. It's a good looking website. I can't judge the validity of, you know, the stuff it recommends, but as far as I know, it's accurate. But is it a good idea? And I'm going to say no. Bear with me here.
Okay.
I'm not saying that WebMD is an unreliable source. As far as I can tell, it's probably reasonably accurate. But they are not owned by a disinterested government organization. They are a for-profit company. They show advertising from pharmaceutical companies. So it just might be in WebMD's best interest to tell you, oh, you could be at risk for depression and ask your doctor about Cymbalta.
Okay. I can kind of see that.
I'm not saying that does happen.
Yeah.
I'm just saying this website exists to make money. They sell ads.
Don't sue us, WebMD.
And you should be aware of that.
Yeah, that's true.
I've got a question for your mom, Brenda, which is, why is she searching the internet for information about health problems?
Mm.
I basically see three scenarios for why someone would do this. The first one is that they have some strange symptom going on and they're curious about it, but it doesn't bother them enough to go to a doctor. Okay, well, if this is the case, practically anything you find on the internet is going to scare you.
That's true.
You know?
Oh, you spend too long on Wikipedia and you're going to be...
they actually did a study on people's searches in 2008, and they show that people who search for headaches would quickly move on to searching for a headache tumor and then onto brain tumor treatment. Almost nobody searched for more likely causes of headaches like stress or caffeine withdrawals.
True.
So you always go for like the worst case scenario.
Sometimes a headache's just a headache.
Exactly.
Well, a lot of times we're driven to search on the internet for what our symptoms are being caused by because we're afraid to go to the doctor because of what they're going to tell us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And doctors have coined a phrase for this, and it's called cyberchondria, which I think is great.
Instead of hyperchondria.
So, you know, you start Googling symptoms and you're going to arrive at these worst case scenarios. Headache, must be a brain tumor. Your stomach hurts, irritable bowel syndrome. Your back hurts, cancer. Listen, if your symptoms are mild enough that you can't be bothered to go to a doctor, you should probably just avoid Googling them. If they persist and you're concerned about them, go to the doctor. And if you're really concerned and you really want to get on the internet, check out one of the nonprofit websites I mentioned earlier first. We will link to them in the show notes.
Well, it's kind of interesting, too, that this also, I would say, would be applicable for computers as well, not just for personal health. If you have computer issues and it's a serious problem with your computer, don't go online looking for registry edits and complex solutions to something which may be as simple as a properties setting. If you have a serious computer problem, talk to a computer expert before you go messing with the internals of your machine.
At least start with a site like ours that you know we're not trying to sell anything.
Exactly.
Often what happens when you search for technical things, you end up on sites that are trying to sell you software.
Absolutely.
or sell you services. No offense to any company that sells services.
Yeah, some of those are very useful software and services, absolutely. But you don't know that going in.
Right, that's true.
To get back to the medical question, okay, second scenario why you might be Googling is your symptoms are severe enough or persistent enough to make you want to go to the doctor. In that case, go to the doctor. Googling, again, isn't going to help. Medical professionals base their diagnoses off multiple symptoms, tests, years of experience, and they're a lot better bet than whatever you find on the interwebs. There is one scenario where I would say it's okay to look for health information on the internet, and that is when your doctor has already given you a diagnosis and you want to find out more about it.
That's true.
If you got some kind of chronic disease or condition, you can probably find, for instance, message boards or forums which will act as support groups. And you can see people regularly logging in, and if you spend time in these support groups, you may be able to figure out and exchange ideas and figure out who to trust. But again, you should only do this after your doctor has given you a firm diagnosis.
All right, well, we've got to take another break. When we come back, we'll take some more of your emails. This is Deemable Tech. If you have a tech question for Deemable Tech, give us a call at 904-372-DEEM. That's 904-372-3336. Or send us an email to questions@deemable.com. If you missed an episode of Deemable Tech, or you just want to hear the show again, be sure to subscribe to our podcast by searching for Deemable Tech in your favorite podcast app, like iTunes or Google Listen. If Deemable Tech isn't listed, you can type in our podcast URL, which is dmbl.co/pod. That's dmbl.co/pod. Also, be sure to follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/deemable, or on Twitter at deemable. You can also find us on Google Plus. Just search for Deemable Tech. Welcome back to Deemable Tech. Let's see, we got another email here from Lydia. Aaron, can you read that one?
Yeah, it says, "What is a QR code? I overheard somebody at the mall looking at a movie poster with a black and white square that looked techie, and they said something about a QR code. What is that?"
Well, actually, you described it pretty well, Lydia. A QR code is a techie-looking black and white square. It kind of looks pixelated, if that makes sense. It's like a blocky, full of little blocks inside of it.
Yeah, it's black and white.
It's hard square, to describe, yeah. Black and white square.
They're pretty distinctive when you see them, though.
Yeah, and they usually have three little squares on each corner.
Yeah, three black squares that kind of form a triangle. Yeah.
It looks kind of like a crossword puzzle.
There you go.
A very small crossword puzzle. Like
once you start looking for them, you will see them everywhere.
Yeah. Literally, a QR code stands for Quick Response Code. They started in the automobile industry that would help manufacturers keep track of parts.
I didn't know that.
Similar to like a barcode or a UPC symbol you might see at the grocery store. The difference is that a barcode is just one line of information. UPC codes are literally just 6 or 12 digit number. You'll notice at the bottom of UPC codes it has a number.
Mm-hmm.
That is literally what the laser scanner reads.
Right.
It doesn't read the numbers, it reads the bars, but it's just a number. It's like translated. Barcodes or UPC codes are one-dimensional. They just read from left to right. But QR codes are two-dimensional. So they have code on them that reads from left to right and up and down. So I'm sure that was really exciting. Here's how that affects you, or how it could affect you. QR codes can have a lot of information stored in them, like web addresses, phone numbers, or other information. And you can read a QR code with a smartphone and a QR code reader app.
Right.
And a lot of companies are starting to put QR codes on their posters and in their ads and magazines and even on billboards. I've seen them.
A lot of people...
And television.
They even put them on their business cards now for a lot of the new techie, edgy kind of businesses, things like that. They'll put a link to their website, for instance, on a QR code so that you just scan it with your phone or your tablet, and it'll automatically go to their webpage.
So let's say you're looking at an ad in a magazine for a product that you're interested in. I don't know. A new tablet, let's say. Okay. Yes. And you'd like to find out more information about it. Instead of having to, you know, pull out your laptop or your phone and type in the web address manually, and or having to go to Google and search the internet for it, you could just grab your phone, open your QR code reader, snap a picture of the phone, and boom, you got the link to the website, and it opens.
Right.
So most QR codes that I've seen, at least, they just have a link to a web address in them. But I have seen a couple that real estate agents have had on their brochures that have their contact information stored in them. So when I scanned the code, I got their name and phone number, email address, and website all in a note on my iPhone. So I didn't have to write any of it down.
And it goes right into your contacts?
You can. The one app that I was using, you could import it directly into your contacts.
Oh, cool.
But that would be based off the app you're using, not necessarily off the QR code.
Yeah.
It doesn't have instructions.
Yeah, the QR code literally just says name, email address, yada, yada, in QR code.
And something I should mention too, like, you know, any phone with a camera can read QR codes, but you're going to need an app. I don't think there's any native apps.
No, phone has a native built-in QR code.
But there are tons and tons of QR code apps out there.
The thing is, with QR codes, they could be really awesome, but they won't be really extremely useful until they're ubiquitous,
right?
Until everybody knows what they are and everybody can read them. And the biggest problem that I've seen with QR codes is that they look really intimidatingly technical, even though they're really fairly easy to use. Most people see that and go, I don't, they see a barcode. Like, if you look at most of your products in the bathroom, they have a QR code on them, but it has nothing to do with anything for the consumer. It's so that they can keep track of inventory.
Well, I'll just say that the consumers, even beyond the QR code, they don't really understand sometimes what their actual devices are capable of.
That's true, too.
You have a smartphone, you go to the store, you pick up, for instance, a box of pasta. You know, a lot of people don't know that you can now scan the barcode on your smartphone, your Android or iPhone, and it'll do a web search for that product, and you'll see recipes, ratings,
reviews.
You know, if it's a DVD, you can scan that DVD and see what people are saying
about it. Shop Savvy does that.
Google Shopper.
There's a couple of them like that. So the QR code is just kind of an addition to that family of thought.
Yeah.
So if you kind of get in the habit of thinking, oh, I can learn more about the things that I'm getting with these by scanning it, you're going to get the same thing out of a QR code. You're going to start looking and saying, hey, does this movie poster have a QR code? I can scan it and see the preview of the movie right here on my device.
Yeah.
Here's a CD. I want to listen to a preview of the first three songs.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem is that there just hasn't been any education about it. You know, like, we don't know, like, everybody knows what Siri does because Apple has pushed it out there and explain it, even if you don't have an iPhone. Like, everybody knows, oh, Siri is that thing that you can ask questions on the iPhone. But QR codes, there's been no real push for it.
There's really no owner for it. I mean, it's kind of a generic, kind of like the barcode. Nobody's really pushing a barcode. It just is. Same thing with the QR code.
And a lot of people,
really,
like,
pushing it. It just is.
You have to download an app to read it. So which app do I use? And, you know, I looked into it, and Microsoft actually has a similar 2D barcode to the QR code called a Microsoft tag. Now, they've done a really good job of promoting it and sharing it with consumers. A Microsoft tag kind of looks like multicolored triangles sitting on shelves. So the appearance is kind of friendlier. It's less techy and intimidating. Also, like I said, Microsoft has been really aggressive about getting companies to post Microsoft tags on their ads and products. And the Microsoft Tag app, which they've pushed out, and it is available on practically all phones, which is really surprising.
Yeah.
It's on iPhone, it's on Android, it's on Windows Phone, Windows Mobile, you know, the old school Windows Mobile, Symbian, which, like, nobody in the U.S. has, but everybody in the rest of the world has, BlackBerry, and even dumb phones, even just J2ME apps.
They call those feature phones.
Feature phones, yeah. I just call them dumb phones.
Dumb phones.
I call them featureless phones.
But you can even go to the app stores on those and download a Microsoft Tag reader.
And
basically, as long as it has a camera and it's not WebOS, it can run it.
And I have a website, and just created a QR code. I just went. I hope you didn't mind.
No, not at all. There's a lot of websites you can create one.
QRcode.kaywa.com. Sure. I just typed in my web address, generated it, and now I have my own QR code. Well, I'll probably put it
print that
on my
out
website
or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. So, although normally I recommend or we recommend, you know, two or more apps when we recommend an app, if you're new to QR codes and you want to check them out, I would start with Microsoft Tag.
Okay.
Because what's nice about the Microsoft Tag app is it reads QR codes and it reads Microsoft Tag codes. Cool. So, and that's the only one that I could find that reads both.
Okay.
So, and it's a really simple to use format. So, you know, download Microsoft Tag on yours and, you know, start when you see QR codes, go ahead and do it. So we got another email. Let's see. Tom, will you grab that one?
Yeah, absolutely. This one says, my friend is helping me customize my phone and just installed a new ROM. And now I can't hear anything when I get an incoming call. The volume is all the way up and I can hear sounds coming out of the phone when I use apps on the device. Is it possibly a problem with the ROM? I have the Pantech Breakout 4G Android phone from Verizon. And thanks for including that information, by the way.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Aaron?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and jump on this one. I'll say that this isn't necessarily an issue with just a custom ROM. Sometimes you may have this if you're doing a major over-the-air update or an OTA update from your carrier, from Sprint or Verizon, AT&T. And what happens is sometimes a new ROM will actually knock out your default ring options. So
yeah, we've talked about this on the show before, but just for maybe new listeners, what's a ROM?
A ROM, that is essentially the operating system for your phone.
So for Android.
Specifically for Android devices, correct. And installing a new ROM would be like installing a custom operating system on your phone.
Okay.
Or an upgraded operating system on your phone.
Cool.
Which will give you a whole bunch of new settings, new features, and that
which
sort
is something
of thing
that you can do with Android that you can't do with, you know, iOS or...
or even the Windows phones at this
point. Yeah.
Okay, so I got a new ROM and it knocked out my default ringtone. So then what?
The best thing to do before blaming the ROM or even the device is to go and check and make sure there's a default ringtone selected. You can do that by going into your phone's system settings. You can go to to all of your apps and then go to settings. And then once you're in there, go to sounds, and under your sounds, make sure that you have a default ringtone selected. Otherwise, whenever your phone rings, even if the volume's all the way up, you're essentially hearing a nothing or a none ringtone.
Oh, I can imitate the none ringtone. There it is.
Oh, man,
that was a beautiful impression, right?
Is there any other reason why it could cause it to go out? I mean... I've heard sometimes that a ROM won't work with the hardware properly, and it might not...
Correct.
Like, if it might not play sounds.
If you're still not having any sounds come out after you have a default ringtone, you may have issues with the custom ROM. So maybe get on a forum for that ROM. If you're running a custom ROM, a lot of times you'll be in the community and talking about it. So see if any other users are having problems with that hardware ROM combination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the nice part about the Android community is there's a lot of them, and I'm not one of them, but there's a lot of them doing it, and so they share that information. Well, see, we got another Android email. I have a rooted Android device, and now I am getting constantly prompted to update my software. This is one of the official updates and is not installing because I have a custom ROM on my phone. Oh, another custom ROM. Okay. It keeps failing, then retrying later. So my phone keeps restarting throughout the day.
Oh, that's going to be fun.
That's the worst thing. My Palm Pre used to do that, just restart, and it takes forever. It's more than just an annoyance. This is really interrupting my typical daily use of the device. Is there any way to block this update?
Absolutely. The easiest solution is to freeze the update program. Now, I'll start with mentioning that unless
So we're going to put the phone in the freezer? That works for getting the moisture out of it. We didn't mention that earlier, but...
No, we're not freezing the phone. We're just going to freeze, and I'll put that in quotes, freeze the update program or the app. Now, I would mention that you need to have a rooted device to do the procedure I'm about to mention, but then again, you shouldn't be dealing with this issue unless you have your... a rooted device, so it kind of goes without saying. Now, there are several apps in the Play Store that will work for this, but I'll just focus on two for this discussion. The first one is called Titanium Backup. Now, I use the free version of this software to back up my apps and user data.
Which is a great idea, as we've been talking about.
Even with phones, it's nice to have a backup. If for nothing else, your data on those apps, you can restore the apps, but restoring your data can sometimes be time-consuming. The pro version of that, which is $4.99, allows you to freeze unwanted stock applications, such as the software update. So if the ROM that you put on there didn't automatically block the stock updates from going through, you can go in there and select the update, software update app, and select freeze, and that'll prevent that program from even showing up in your system settings that you have an update. There's a free option now called Link2SD. And if you're running Android 2.2 or higher, which just about everybody these days should, it's a nice tool for moving apps to your SD card, but also gives you the ability to force move applications that don't support moving, like your stock apps, and even the ability to convert stock apps to user apps and vice versa. So that's kind of a nice free version that you can get in addition to Titanium Backup.
And I use another one, I think it's called Move to SD, and it actually, one of the nice features I like about it is that it kind of tells you if you're moving an app to an SD card, it is going to limit some of the features of that app.
Correct. Sometimes widgets and things like that are apps that heavily rely on widgets like Facebook and things like that. If you move them to your SD card, you can cause problems. So that is a good thing to be aware of. I mean, like I said, Link to SD is just one of the things that are on the Play Store, but Move to SD does a similar feature, and there's several of them now that have kind of copied that.
All right. Well, it looks like we've got time for one more email. Kevin, you got that one?
Sure. John N. says, I have Clear, which used to be Clearwire. Clear is the new 4G version of what used to be Clearwire and 3G. He says, for my internet, and I have an email account through them. When I go into my Clear email, it doesn't have all the nice features like Outlook does, like searching, sorting, previews, etc. Do you have any idea where I can find more the advanced features for my Clear email address or some other way to get them?
Okay, well, that's a good question, John. I don't have a Clear email account, and I can't get one without signing up for Clear Internet, which I'm not going to do, unfortunately. So it's kind of hard to tell you what your Clear email can and can't do, or at least I can't tell you that. But you mentioned that you use Outlook and you like the way it works. Did you know you can just use Outlook to check your Clear email account?
Hmm.
Yeah.
You can do that?
You can totally do that.
Some people don't realize, I think, that Outlook is not an email in itself, but it's just a client.
It's a tool to access email.
Your emails into.
Yeah. Let me give you a really brief rundown, and this can get more technical. I'm just going to give you the high points of how this would generally work. If you have Outlook or Windows Live Mail, like Kevin just said, they're clients, and you can point them to just about any kind of email account. What you need to know about is two things called POP and SMTP, and that sounds technical, but let me explain. When you got separate computers talking to each other, or systems talking to each other, for example, an email program on your computer and an email server out there in the internet somewhere, they use things called protocols to communicate. And it's just a common language that the two systems share. All right, there are three protocols the computers use to talk to each other about email: POP or POP, IMAP or IMAP, and SMTP. As long as your email account provider has servers that support POP and SMTP, you can use Outlook to read and send from that account. You really just need to set up your account in Outlook and point Outlook to those servers. Almost everybody supports these protocols, so Clear, you should be good. And from what I read on their website, Clear definitely does.
Does Clear do IMAP as well?
I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. One of the things I found, I started Googling around in the Clear website, and I found a great page that seemed to show you how to set up access to Clear from your iPhone, from Outlook, Outlook Express, everything. And then I started clicking on these links, and they're all broken. Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, I can't get more specific than that, but they claim they do. They also say that their email is actually hosted through Gmail, which probably means...
They're using Google Apps.
Yeah, they're using Google Apps, and you could just point to the Gmail servers. The Gmail servers happen to be pop.gmail.com and smtp.gmail.com and imap.gmail.com.
Yeah, so since they're using Google Apps, they may have IMAP, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Now, if so, the what you would need to do to enable that is you would actually first need to go into your Clear account, go to settings, and you'll see a tab that says import, export, IMAP. Click on that, and you're going to have to enable POP and IMAP. Or POP may be enabled by default, but you probably need to check on it.
I was going to say, POP is usually defaulted on most emails that I've come in contact with. IMAP usually has to be enabled. And the reason for that, for the listeners to kind of understand just briefly, is simply POP is designed for retrieval of email. So it goes to your email server, Hotmail, Clear, etc., and will get your email and bring it back to your Outlook. Whereas IMAP actually has two-way synchronization, so it allows you to put data back on the server so you can sync up your contacts and calendar things, sometimes more than just an email account.
Mm-hmm. And if you set up with POP, make sure that you check, there's a box on there that says leave the data on the server. Otherwise, it's going to delete the emails out of your account to download it to Outlook. And it's nice to have them in both places in case you don't have Outlook in front of you and you still want to check your email.
Yeah, otherwise it'll only be available on the computer you have Outlook on. So people need to be aware of that.
Yeah, and what we'll do is we'll put some of these notes on our show to give you a little bit more details.
Google
about
has
this.
Some nice walkthroughs and stuff.
But that is all the time that we've got for today. Thanks for all your emails and your voicemails, and definitely keep them coming. Our email address is questions@deemable.com, and our phone number is 904-632-DEEM. Our producer is Sean Birch. I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
I'm Kevin Clark.
I'm Aaron Edelson.
And this is Deemable Tech. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.